Session number 11944.
His Honour, Judge Jalland, Reel 13.
I was, in fact, only at Brigade Headquarters as a liaison officer in Nijmegen for a few weeks, because in November 1944, we learnt that the division was to be returned to the UK. We had landed as one of the assault divisions on D-Day, but the plan had been that we were to be expendable. And in an address which was given to us by Field Marshal Montgomery in Popperinge on the way home, he informed us that the plan had been that perhaps we would have been we would have ceased to be a fighting division after 6 days. In other words, we were expendable. We stayed in Popperinge for only a short time. It was interesting to be able to go to Talbot House, which of course was the home of the Toc H movement and Tubby Clayton in the First World War. And then we were sent back to England from there. By that time I had left Brigade Headquarters and been returned to the 8th Battalion DLI, where I became assistant adjutant to George Chambers, who was the head, who was the commanding company commander of S Company, but who was acting adjutant at the time. The 8th Battalion's adjutant having been killed, George made me his assistant adjutant. We were went from Ostend back to Keighley in Yorkshire. We had been, we were told that we could, we were to bring not more than 100 people back from the battalion. All the 100 people should have landed on D-Day, and there should be not more than 10 officers in the 100. As far as the 8th Battalion was concerned, we simply did not have 100 people left who had landed on D-Day, although we had landed at a strength of exceeding 1,000. We'd had to take some people who had joined us later. We went back to Keighley, West Yorkshire. Very few of us knew the place, but the town welcomed us with open arms. They were absolutely magnificent. There were some 30 clubs in the town. We were made honorary members of every club. We couldn't buy a drink in any club, and in fact we couldn't buy a drink in a public house. Every time we went for a drink in any of them, the drinks were given to us. And there were dances. As an assistant adjutant, I had a special diary to record the invitations that the battalion, all ranks, received from various groups and bodies, such as the Girls in Boots, the staff at Woolworths, the town hall staff wanting to give us dinner dances and get-togethers and so on. And it was a very remarkable Christmas period, because it was Christmas by the time we arrived. We settled in very quickly, but in January we learnt of our new role, and this was to retrain various people so that we could all go out to the Far East to continue the fight against the Japanese. I, by this time, had become adjutant of the battalion, George having gone back to his own company. And from January onwards, we started receiving the replacements. And they were not what we'd expected, because we, instead of receiving infantrymen like ourselves, we received personnel from the Army, the Navy and the Air Force. They had been cooks, clerks, aircraft fitters, sailors, all sorts of people who were no longer required by their own units, but who we were now to convert into light infantry soldiers. The mixture was not inconsiderable, and it was a very difficult job, because the people who came to us particularly people like the gunners and the engineers and so on, who were sent to be turned into infantry, bitterly resented leaving their own regiments, units, corps, and being made into light infantry. Fortunately, the light infantrymen themselves went out of their way to be kind and welcoming and friendly, and we did everything we could, all ranks, to smooth the entry of these people into what was for them a completely new way of life. And they were to be given field training and so on. They were also given very nasty plastic cap badges, of which we were very ashamed. Instead of our much treasured silver bugle with DLI on it, we were given these plastic things which wouldn't flash in the bright jungle sunlight and give away people's positions to the Japanese. It was a ridiculous state of affairs altogether. But it worked well, and we got the people into companies, we got them trained, the basic training, and they generally muscled down. So, and looking back, it was surprising there was so little desertion and going absent without leave, and things of that kind. And it gradually fitted together until by August we were all completely kitted for the Far East. Everybody had been trained, everybody was in companies, the whole battalion was ready to go again. And I went on embarkation leave to North Wales in August prior to going out to the Far East. And it was whilst I was there that the two atomic bombs were dropped on Japan and the war was over. And I, for one, have never ceased to approve of the use of atomic weapons at that stage in the war. I returned to my unit to find that everything was to be changed, and in effect the battalion was to be disbanded, in that it was put into what was to be called suspended animation. This meant that our new intake all had to be returned to their own units, be it Army, Navy or Air Force, and in addition to that, of course, releases on war and service numbers was to take place. I was still adjutant. The amount of work which my staff had to do at that period was absolutely phenomenal, and I personally and the chief clerk and so on in the orderly room and the other clerks were often working till 2 and 3 in the morning making sure the documentation was right, because although the War Office provided us with the age and service group numbers of every single individual, but so that we could deal with their releases in an orderly fashion. But we had to, our clerks had to work out how much leave they were entitled to, release leave, what their pay was to be, what their rations were to be, and of course the quartermaster staff had to make sure that all the appropriate equipment was recovered from them. By this time, we had left Keighley and gone to UNIAC barracks at Harrogate. And it was, again, by then December, so he had been back in the United Kingdom for about 12 months after leaving Nijmegen, the war in Europe, of course, having meanwhile finished. We stayed there at UNIAC barracks for a very short time, and people were drifting away all the time. They were being sent on release, and parties were held night after night to say goodbye to our old comrades and those who'd survived. I was, of course, not a Durham Light Infantry man. My own regiment was the King's Own Royal Regiment at Lancaster, although I'd served with the Durhams for so long. And those who were not due for release with age and service group numbers, people such as myself who were so young, because I was for a long time the baby of the mess, being the youngest by a considerable period, I was to go back to my depot, a new regiment, and see what happened from there. But it wasn't to happen in that way, so far as I personally was concerned, because we got a new commanding officer, even at that late stage. And he was a regular soldier, and a colonel, lieutenant colonel, and had the misfortune to be taken prisoner in the Gazala box with, I think, the 6th Battalion. And as a result, he'd spent much of the war as a prisoner of war. He came back to the battalion as a regular soldier, and I think he simply didn't appreciate what had happened. And we felt, a number of us felt, that he resented the fact that some of us had served, we hope loyally, with the battalion during the war years, while he had been a prisoner of war. And there we were, in positions such as company commander or adjutant, far earlier than he would have been able to attain during his period in the regular army. And I really did feel that he, at 22, he must have, I think, resented my being adjutant, when adjutants were usually older and more mature people. And it's all, in the end, we got on reasonably well, but he was very short-tempered, very bad-tempered, and was not prepared to listen to the new changes that had taken place since he'd been away. And unfortunately, this led up to an incident, as far as I was concerned, in his office at UNIAC Barracks, when one morning he asked me why he should do so and so and so and so. I forget what it was now. It's perhaps signing the reports of courts of inquiry or something like that, why I needed 6 copies and so on. And I made the reply that it was because it was required in King's regulations. And he lost his temper. Perhaps he thought I was being insolent. I don't know, but he picked up a bottle of ink and threw it at me. And I ducked, the top came off the bottle of ink, and it went all down his office wall. And I saluted smartly and walked out. And I was very, very cross indeed that I had been treated in that way as adjutant of the battalion by this, I regard as a newcomer. I went straight back to my office, and I telephoned one of my superiors, because of course I was military secretary's Barnes as adjutant, one of my superiors at Northern Command, and I told him exactly what had happened, and I said that I wasn't prepared to put up with this, and I wanted a posting, and were there any postings going. I didn't particularly want to go back to the depot, either of the Durham Light Infantry or the King's Own. And he told me to leave it with him, and he'd communicate with me later in the day. He did ring up about tea time, and I was offered 2 appointments. One was a staff captain in Gibraltar, and the other was a staff captain in Cyprus. I immediately elected to go to Cyprus as a staff captain, and I was told that I was to go on leave, embarkation leave, within the next 24 hours, and that I should make arrangements with my assistant adjutant, a man called Bill Walsh, to complete the suspended animation of the battalion. I should say that by that time there were probably only 200 people left in the battalion anyway, the others all having gone and the work having been done. And in that way I left the 8th Battalion of the Durham Light Infantry. The colonel asked me to reconsider. He was upset, and somebody no more upset than I was that my service with the battalion should end in that way, through what I regard as being no fault of mine. And I then left UNIAC Barracks and West Yorkshire, and went home and got married to my future wife, who had waited patiently for 4 years till the war was over. I then went out to Cyprus.
What happened to the colonel? Did you find out how his future went?
The colonel and I remained in correspondence until he died, only a few years ago, We were the best of friends. We met at reunion dinners. He frequently apologised and said that he was sorry, and I said, oh, it was all right, it was all forgotten. And that was that, but we became reasonably good friends afterwards. And it was probably just a combination of the clash of personalities, perhaps. But, of course, it was unfortunate at the time.
How did the soldiers who were sent home feel when they were told they were going back to be the cadre for a, what was effectively going to be a new battalion?
Oh, they were.
What else? Were they?
The gunners and people. Mm. Oh, they were furious. Mm. They were the ones who were brought back.
No, I'm talking about the ones who came back with you from Elst when you went back to England.
Oh, they're delighted.
Yes.
Oh, yes, they were delighted.
They weren't sorry at leaving the rest of the battalion in
well, the whole lot came back.
The whole lot came back.
The whole battalion came back. The whole brigade came back. The whole of 151 Brigade ceased to operate from Elst onwards.
So it ceased to exist entirely?
In due course. It was stayed as a training brigade under Brigadier Walker for the next 12 months. But then when the Japanese war finished, they folded completely.
When you were training to meet the Japanese in battle, what sort of training were you doing? Was it just ordinary basic?
Ordinary basic.
Nothing special to the theatre then?
No, no. Well, you can't really make the Yorkshire Moors look like the jungle, I don't think, I suspect.
How much did you know about Japan and the Japanese army?
Nothing. Nothing. We didn't. We'd heard what we'd been told in lectures and so on, but nothing at all, really. And I don't think we were really interested. I think we felt that it was the war was getting to an end anyway, and we were, although we weren't anticipating the atomic bombs, we suspected that we might become involved in island hopping across the Pacific and that sort of activity. But looking back, I don't think we were terribly worried about it. It was going to take months before we got out there anyway, and a month in the army in wartime is a long time.
Presumably you would have been given training in the theatre when you got there.
Presumably. We'd all heard about Chindits and so on. But apart from that, we didn't know. The Japanese war seemed to be chiefly an American affair. We lost Hong Kong, we lost Singapore, the Burma had gone, and Malaya, and there seemed to be very little connection.
There were battalions of the Dharmite Infantry in Burma.
Oh yes, yes, but we were most of us by this time were not regular soldiers. We were not regular Durhams. We were wartime Durhams, and from all walks of life and all different regiments. So there was no territorial feeling, I don't think, at that time.
What happened to you then when you got out to Cyprus?
When I went out to Cyprus, that was opened up a very interesting period in my life. Yes, it was early in January 1945 that I set off for Cyprus. I went on what was called the Medlock route. This involved a train journey across France to Toulon, followed by a sea crossing to Egypt, and thereafter an air passage to Cyprus. It was a very unpleasant journey across France in the train. The French train was in a very bad state of disrepair, broken windows, a few lights, disgusting toilet facilities, and many parts were missing. It was snowing at the time. The snow came in through the broken windows in the carriages, and everywhere was wet. And it took 36 hours to reach the south of France, with no stops except for one at Toulouse, where the only food we had consisted of a sandwich and a mug of tea. We crossed the Mediterranean on an American Liberty ship called the Empire Battle Axe, which was again very basic, but the flight to Cyprus by Mizzer Airlines from Cairo was altogether excellent. In Cyprus, I became head of A branch, command headquarters in Wolseley Barracks in Nicosia, the capital of the island. The commander of the island, apart from the governor, Sir Charles Woolley, who was the titular head of the forces, was Brigadier Anstis, and most popular regular soldier with a charming wife. The headquarters was based on a brigade footing, so that my experience at HQ 151 Brigade was invaluable to me. I was there for 11 months, because I was not there for 12 months, regulations prevented my wife from joining me. Had it been a 12-month posting, she could have joined me, but she couldn't. My work was pretty routine, but I had plenty of time to explore the island. I came to love the Greek and Turkish populations, who at that time seemed to like the British very much. There were rumblings from the Enesis movement, the Union with Mother Greece people, but Greece didn't want them because Cyprus was a financial liability. We worked very hard, keeping fit, playing games and running, and because of the heat, over 100 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade, made it difficult for anybody to work in the middle of the day. I devised a scheme whereby everybody started work at 6 o'clock in the morning and we all finished at 2 p.m. and it worked very well and was very popular. There was still in the island at that time a number of murderous bandits, and the army cooperated with the police to hunt them down. I had many meetings with Inspector Vivash, who was organising the campaign against the bandits. There were two main killers. One I remember was called Midas, and the other was called Themistocleus. There was a price on their heads, and I remember seeing notices of a type which I'd never seen before or since, which were nailed on trees and other public places, containing the photographs of the bandits and reading, "Wanted, dead or alive, Midas, £1,000 reward." We knew that in the main they were being sheltered in the local monasteries, but eventually they were both caught and killed.
Were they actually executed, or were they killed in the
court? Killed shot. They were killed by the security forces hunting them. Themistocleus had a rifle with his name, Themistocleus, carved on the side, on the butt, and the notches for the people he'd killed. He was a real killer.
What sort of chaps were they? Were they operating solitary and on their own, or did they have? They didn't have groups with them then.
Not. They weren't kind of groups of terrorists. They may have had one or two people with them, but they were bandits in the old Wild Western sense of the word. But they were chiefly hidden by the monks in the monasteries.
Why should the monks have done that?
Well, they did. I don't know. They did. The monks were all tied up with the Enesis movement as well. They were all nationalists and anti-British and so on. But of course, a lot of the victims of the bandits were the local Cypriot people, shopkeepers and bank managers and so on. It was a very interesting period, and it was an interesting use of the army.
How were they actually caught? Were they given away?
I don't know. I think Inspector Vivash got them in the end, and some of his policemen.
Were the police then all native, all Cypriots?
Oh yes, apart from the... It was rather like the Palestine police. They'd have a few English officers, but in the main they were locals. Greek and Turkey. And a very smart body of men they were too. And it was there we came across, the Cyprus Regiment, which I mentioned earlier. Oh, and they were under Colonel Muftizadeh, were a very impressive body of men who spent most of the time as muleteers in Italy and had a very fine, worn record. There was a lot of smuggling going on there too, which involved me and my department, because gangs, there was an organisation which was known locally as the North Levant Fishing Patrol. And this consisted of caiques, or boats, old wooden boats, sailing boats, with a very powerful engine in them. And they were manned originally by the RASC. And they had, in fact, been used for Ireland raiding against the Germans during the war, operating the Peloponnese. When the war finished and these raids, commando raid type raids, ceased, the North Levant Fishing Patrol was kept intact, and it used to continue with its training in the sense that it would drive steam up from Alexandria up to Piraeus, Greece, with a load of unspecified goods, which would then be unloaded and replaced with goods in short supply from Greece, which would be brought down to Cyprus, and Kyrene and Famagusta in particular. And then there'd be another change of cargo, and the boat went back to Alexandria. Triangular trip, which we all knew was very lucrative, because they were trading in things like fur coats and anything else that could be transported easily. And also, of course, there was a huge profit to be made on exchange rates of currency. That was being watched quite hard. And it involved, of course, the not only the special branch, our own special investigation branch, the SIB, who were under my control, but it also involved the Royal Navy and, to some extent, the Air Force from Nicosia Main Airport. That was a very interesting period, and it was provided.
How did you coordinate then with the other services? Did you just do it by direct personal liaison?
With the local commanders, the naval commander in Kyrenia, for example, he was in charge.
Did you have a regular system of having daily or weekly meetings with these officers, or did you just meet ad hoc?
Yeah, largely ad hoc, or ring them up.
And you mentioned the SIB. Presumably they were military police.
It's the Special Investigation Branch of the military police.
Were these men all regulars, or were they also...
Oh, no, not regulars. They were all the same.
They were solicitors only?
Yeah.
How many did you have in your SIB?
I think now about eight. They were involved too, of course, with the bandits as well. And they used to put civilian clothes on and black baggy trousers and fezzes and all sorts of things, and generally disguise themselves as not being military policemen. But
what sort of chaps were they in the SIB? Were there any particular type of man who had...
One of them that I did follow for a little time became a sergeant in the Greater Manchester Police. And I think they were, in fact, peacetime police officers, really. And that they were that type of man. They were very fine men and very, very brave doing their job, because they weren't popular necessarily when all this wickedness was going on with the civilian population. Because, of course, the smugglers were chiefly civilians, both Greek and Turkish.
You say they were naturally policemen. Were they mainly of the type who make good detectives, or were they...
Oh, I wouldn't know. They'd been picked by the military police. They were, you know, they're part of the military police force. The commander in those days was Major Kirkwood, who was in charge of the... He was the provost marshal in our headquarters, and I think he picked them to some extent. But very often they came in as SIB men from Cairo, and GHQ in Cairo sent them.
What sort of goods were being smuggled into Cyprus then? What was their demand for?
I don't know. There were things like tyres, certainly fur coats were coming in from Greece. Cigarettes, drink, that sort of thing. I don't think in those days, looking back, and I've not thought about it for 40 years, I don't think there are any drugs or anything like that.
Just standard black market commodities.
Black market commodities that could be sold through the markets around the towns and places like Cairo and so on. They could quite easily be stolen goods, of course.
Well, if they were tyres, they'd probably be, wouldn't they? Military tyres?
Probably, yeah. German or whatever they happen to be. Because there were quite a number of rackets going on in that part of the world where we had, not in Cyprus, but I do know that on the mainland there were units which didn't exist, which were...
their rations and things.
Oh, yes, and their money.
And their money.
And their money. And there was one unit on the canal, the Suez Canal, which was a repair shop, an LAD. And they were inspected by the hygiene department from Cairo, and it was reported that they hadn't got enough fly netting in the kitchen, in the cookhouse. So GHQ sent a message to Canal North saying, not enough fly netting, take action. Canal North sent the message back saying, this unit not known here, try Canal South. So they tried Canal South, and they wrote back and said, not known here, try district. So Ismailia district. So Ismailia district were contacted, and they'd never heard of this particular unit. And so investigations were commenced, and it was found out this particular unit consisted of a couple of officers, and